So really what this reminds us that the whole context of Palestinian Israeli, Arab Israeli, Hezbollah Israeli, Iran Israeli, whatever you want to look at, has not worked very well. There has been no serious diplomacy that tries to address the underlying causes and resolve them. And they're all resolvable. These are human, man-made, woman-made issues that can be resolved by human beings. But the United States is not able to mediate impartially, except on a few technical issues here and there, like the oil leases and things like that. But on issues that are dear to Zionism, which is, you know, to assert its authority in the region, the U.S. is fully on the Israeli side. And this is one of the problems that we have.
Well, Rami Kouri, I want to thank you for being with us. There's clearly much more to talk about it, and we will over the coming days. Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, also non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development to lead our fundraising team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. This month's Board of Directors meeting will be held on Monday, July 29th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This morning, we will not be broadcasting More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule. And thank you for listening to KBOO, Portland.
COVID Action.
Welcome to COVID Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of COVID Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa. Just over 100 days away from the 2024 election, Joe Biden has dropped out of the race and endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, signaling to the Democratic Party that there is to be no debate, no other nominations, and certainly no floor fight for delegates at the upcoming Democratic National Convention next month. This, of course, comes after a period where there are no real primaries for the Democratic Party, which isn't unusual when a sitting president is running for re-election, but questions about Biden's ability to lead and to beat Donald Trump have been lingering for quite some time. Today, we want to get into who Harris is, what interests she represents, and what the absolute lack of democracy in the so-called Democratic Party means for social movements and real change through November and beyond. For this conversation, we are very happy to be joined again by activist, author, and journalist Eugene Puryear, who's the host of the Freedom Side Live on Breakthrough News. Eugene, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me back on. Happy to be here.
Wow, great to have you. I want to start out with this poll, Reuters Ipsos poll. Not sure if you all have seen it. Just came out very, very recently this afternoon that Harris leads Trump 44% to 42% in the race. This is apparently the first poll, possibly the only poll that's been done since Biden actually announced that he's dropping out. So it's really the first hard numbers that show what a real Harris candidacy means versus a possible Harris candidacy. We had seen some of those polls, of course, before Biden's announcement. But 44 to 42%, I mean, that's not very favorable for either of them. And we should mention that this has a 3 percentage point margin of error in this poll, which to me, I mean, there could be a pretty decent gap there, but it also could be a statistical dead heat when you look at the numbers finally. I think part of it is that people don't know who Harris is. And for those who do know who she is, she represents more of the same. I mean, listen, Eugene, I gotta say it, it's Jover, but who is Kamala Harris? Where does she come from? Why is her nickname Kamala? Let's start there.
The nickname itself comes from the fact that she was the district attorney of San Francisco and that she was the attorney general of the state of California. So more or less her entire professional career prior to being a U.S. senator, and then, of course, being a part of President Joe Biden's campaign, and then subsequently, you know, being the vice president herself, that essentially she was a part of the law enforcement world. That was how she came to the forefront. And in fact, it was one of the main appeals that she brought forward. And I think one of the factors that people have used to sort of label her as Kamala is the fact that, was she the toughest of law and order people in terms of her rhetoric? No, but she certainly was someone who was working in many different ways to push forward the system of mass incarceration and had a lot of contradictions. For instance, when she was district attorney, she was against the death penalty and seeking the death penalty in the state of California, which many people appreciated. But when she came to be attorney general, she fought to prevent a DNA test for Kevin Cooper, who was someone who was on the death row of the state of California. He was claiming his innocence, but he needed the DNA test. She was trying to stop that in every way possible. She was also somebody who wanted to jail parents over the issue of truancy as a way to try to keep more kids in school. You would actually use the threat of imprisonment of their parents in order to, you know, try to compel them to, I guess, force their kids to go into school. And there are many other elements of her record that are out there. She, of course, always represented herself as a, you know, progressive prosecutor and so on and so forth. And there were various different things that she looked into and did. And she was also not looking to enforce the three strikes law in California. But when you look at it by and large, you can see that, as one person said, she fought tooth and nail to keep people in jail and many different opportunities. And in fact, you know, she used to call it being smart on crime, which ultimately means that at the end of the day, you know, you were trying to maintain basically the system of mass incarceration with just some things around the edges. And when she was attorney general, this is when many of the larger issues were coming to the forefront about the overcrowding of the prisons in California. The U.S. Supreme Court found that the overcrowding was so bad that it violated the constitutional bar on cruel and unusual punishment. But Harris, as attorney general, actually argued that a number of prisoners should not be released because it would deplete the pool for prison labor, which gives you a sense. And I've already mentioned, you know, one innocence case, and she was not great on other innocence cases as well. You know, often at different times, she was unwilling to take up the issue of law enforcement officials who were engaged in serious misconduct. There was a state prosecutor, for instance, Robert Murray, who falsified a confession and that was used to threaten a defendant with life in prison. The indictment was thrown out. Harris's office appealed it because they were trying to protect this prosecutor. So it gives you a sense of where she's at. Her office, when she was attorney general, also opposed a bill that would have required the attorney general to investigate killings by police and efforts to create standards for police body-worn cameras. So you can see that there was significant resistance there to her for a number of important criminal justice reforms. So, you know, in the context of the state of California, obviously there's a strong progressive movement there that wanted to address mass incarceration. She spoke to that in many ways, especially as DA in San Francisco. But bottom line, people call her Kamala because, especially when she was attorney general, she was very willing to buttress the status quo as it considered mass incarceration in California.
Certainly, Eugene, I really appreciate the context that you've given us here. I think right now I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on the Democratic Party's thinking in moving towards choosing Kamala and kind of the way that they're framing this, because I think you're absolutely right. I think Kamala's track record speaks for itself in many ways, but the rebranding that's happening right now is very aggressive. It's right out the gates, in particular, a strong focus on Gen Z. I mean, they're leaning right into all of these crazy memes about Kamala and her coconut tree, which originally the meme was all about the fact that she's kind of corny, and they're trying to flip it in such a way to make it seem as though she somehow resonates with youth. It's a very interesting model. I mean, they're rebranding her to use Charlie XCX's like branding. They're using that for their Kamala HQ. So it's so clear that they're trying to get the youth vote. It's so clear the kind of strategy they're coming in here with. But I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on the choice of Kamala, and in particular, what the Democrats are exactly cooking up, and realistically, what shot they have against Trump in this change.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, first and foremost, what they're thinking with Kamala is they had to have somebody who was, you know, more energetic than Biden. And I think she was just the most obvious option. I think the fact that she was already vice president, the fact that, you know, she is a Black woman and the base of the Democratic Party now has become so diverse. I think the thought process was someone younger, someone more articulate, someone who is at least sort of physically and from an ancestry point of view, you know, maybe more relatable to many of our voters, that it'll help increase enthusiasm and excitement around the candidacy. And of course, Gen Z, I think it's good to mention, because Gen Z is one of the areas, the younger people in the country, that the Democrats have been losing significantly because of the war in Gaza, but also because of many other things, including the economy, where many young people feel like they're not only hurt like everyone around inflation, but they can see it vis-a-vis their future. They don't see the possibility of owning a home, of buying a home, of living a better life than their parents did. All the sort of markers of success that we're told as kids all the things that we're told as kids are markers of success, I should say. And so ultimately, I think that this is one of the constituencies, along with Black voters, is one of the constituencies where you were seeing the most erosion amongst the Democratic Party base over a range of issues, the economy, Gaza, just generally the Democrats not proposing solutions that meet the scale of the problem and the on and on everyday churn that exists in society. So I think that is a lot of their thinking around this in terms of why they're bringing her forward. I mean, I do think, going back to our previous conversation, you know, and Politico had a piece about this, the fact that she was a prosecutor doesn't look as bad now when we're in the backlash from the 2020 uprising and this, you know, fake crime wave scare that's going forward, everything happening at the border. You could already see, you know, 2019, when she ran in the primary, she had an ad against Trump, and it was like, Kamala Harris has prosecuted fraudsters and fake colleges. Like, Trump started a fake college. Kamala Harris has prosecuted this. So contrasting basically the people she's put behind bars with Trump himself, and you can already see in the speech she gave to her staff, same sort of approach. She said, I know Donald Trump's type. I've prosecuted people just like him. I actually saw someone who's a, you know, influencer that's promoting Kamala Harris say, she's the prosecutor, he's the convict, and in November, we're the jury. And they said that's an official line they're going to be rolling out to surrogates. I don't know if that's true or false. But you can see they're also, I think, trying to lean into that element of her appeal to, in some ways, the same way she kind of got elected as attorney general, to sort of have this idea that, like, okay, yeah, maybe we need to change some things around the edges on criminal justice, but I too really care about law and order and will push those things in. So I think even though the Republicans feel that they're going to attack her around the issue of the border and crime and so on and so forth, I think the Democrats might feel that they have some level of strength on that point because of her history as a prosecutor, her history of doing things like fighting, releasing people from prison in California. And I do think it is a potent contrast with Donald Trump. I mean, to be able to say, I prosecuted sexual abusers, which she did. And Donald Trump is a serial sexual abuser from what has been laid out in the courts, at the very least, to say that she prosecuted fake colleges or these, you know, diploma mills and that he ran one. That is an interesting contrast. So I think all these things are really coming together, but I do feel it's to some degree circumstantial. I think had there been a real primary, I don't believe she would have emerged. In 2020, she dropped out before the first vote was ever cast because she was getting no support from Black voters. Elizabeth Warren had more support amongst Black voters than Kamala Harris. She wasn't getting any support really from young voters. She wasn't getting any in the first debate. She looked like she was going to steal a march on Bernie Sanders because she made that very strong defense of universal health care. But then as soon as the debate was over, she walked it back. So progressive voters didn't rally around to her. So there's not a natural base for Kamala in the Democratic Party. There's not a lot of people who love her, but there are so many Democrats who hate Trump that you can see having someone who they think can really mix it up with Trump is increasing enthusiasm amongst the Democratic Party base. But I think it's a combination of things. I think it's their hope that she can speak to certain communities, also their hope that she'll be able to use her pass as a prosecutor to maybe blunt the edges of some of the law and order type critiques that the Republicans are putting forward.
Yeah, you know, looking at the way that this entire process is unfolding. I mean, we haven't seen anything like this in, I mean, a very long time, if we ever have. But you remind, you know, it's a great reminder that she barely was able to campaign in 2020. She, you know, did not, like, in the primaries, she, you're right, she dropped out before any vote was cast. She had no real position of her own or base of her own that propelled her into any kind of, you know, position to challenge any of the other candidates. And so they're avoiding that entire question at this point. I know a lot of Democrats who I've talked to over the past couple of days, they're like, fine, we're going to do a 2020 all over again. I'm going to hold my nose. I'm going to vote for her, but I'm not happy about this. And what they're not happy about is the process. They've been saying Joe Biden can't handle the campaign. He probably couldn't beat Trump, all of that. And they've been saying this for months. And this has been rumblings from the base of the Democratic Party, not the politicos, not the, you know, people who are writing op-eds, but people who are out on the street, union members, family members, you know, just folks who are out there saying Biden can't win this. And now they're frustrated, folks I'm talking to, because they're saying, like, well, we had no choice. We had no say. What if we wanted somebody else? What if we wanted to vet somebody else? I mean, the campaign season in the U.S., when you look at most other countries in the world, is ridiculously long, but it's what we've got and what we're used to. We're used to having more time to vet somebody, to look at some options and all of that. The Democrats won't even give us that. The DNC is a month away. They won't even say, all right, let's have an accelerated timeline. It's just they're basically taking the crown off of Biden, putting it on Harris. And that's that. And I think that's actually going to harm them in the long run in terms of engagement with Democratic voters, because even if Harris wins the presidency, it was done without the say of the Democratic base. So even if she does manage to beat Trump, even if these numbers, you know, get a little bit of a boost and she beats Trump, people are frustrated that they had absolutely no say in who the candidate that they're supposed to be so excited for wins. We also should mention, too, the fact that she did raise $80-something million very quickly. But I think that was more of a panic situation about, all right, how do we beat Trump than anything else? That's kind of how I'm looking at that. But Eugene, I also want to ask you about her position, because we're talking to you. You're in D.C. We're speaking on Tuesday afternoon. You're in D.C. Netanyahu is now in town and is supposed to address Congress tomorrow. So you're going to be at this massive rally at the outside the Capitol tomorrow. I've been hearing people call it, what is it? Fortress Netanyahu, the way they have fortified the U.S. Capitol. So Harris seems to have been put out as sort of a softer Biden administration position, you know, over the past few months on Palestine. You know, she was the one who kind of announced initially a ceasefire or a call for a ceasefire. This is, you know, many months ago. She is putting a little criticism on Netanyahu, you know, very, very slight, you know, even more, you know, a little bit more than Biden would, but I think that was very intentional. So when it comes to the question of Palestine and of U.S. foreign policy in general, how are you seeing Harris?
Yeah, well, I think it's an important question. And I think we have to recognize that even what we've seen over the past few months, I mean, and the biggest one is when she went to the commemoration of the Selma march during the civil rights movement and called for a ceasefire, which of course was met with broad cheers because a very significant subset of African-Americans want to see a ceasefire and end to all U.S. military aid to Israel. The NAACP has called for that. The African Methodist Episcopal Church has called for that. You can see if you go back and read Charles Blow, the New York Times columnist, his second column about why Black voters were upset about Palestine. It was amazing to see, you know, the leaders and young leaders of a lot of groups in the civil rights community talking about why it was they were against it. So Kamala Harris was put out there to try to channel some of that. But in general, there has been no daylight. The conversation that they've been putting out, I believe it was the Times of Israel reported that in her private meeting she's going to have with Netanyahu, she's going to reaffirm America's strong support for Israel's right to defend itself. She herself has been a very strong supporter of Israel. It's been one of the most central pieces of her politics since she became attorney general. She once actually declared the founding of Israel to be similar to the civil rights movement, trying to bring those two things together. I believe it was in 2020 where it was all the Democratic candidates were skipping AIPAC. She ultimately tried to go secretly, but she still went and spoke with AIPAC leaders. She's been a consistent spokesperson for different pro-Zionist groups throughout her entire career in the Senate. And this is not to say it's because of her husband, but I think it is worth noting that her husband, Douglas Emhoff, after October 7th, has been one of the main voices solidarizing with the Zionist community and the Zionist movement. And so on that front, I think it's hard to know exactly what to expect, because I'm sure she's also thinking about her own electoral circumstances and she wants to win the election. So I don't know exactly how she will try to position. It is certainly very possible she'll try to find a way to make it seem as if she is better on the issue of Palestine, but I think it'll all be skin deep and cosmetic. I mean, her entire career has been so pro-Palestinian, almost as pro-Palestinian as Joe Biden his entire career. And I think that's an important factor when we're considering where she is. We've also seen that they've put her out there vis-a-vis Zelensky in Ukraine. She's met with him several times. She's been a voice in favor of more funding for Ukraine. She's been someone who's out there trying to explain and carry that line. So we see that there's no daylight between her and Joe Biden on the issue of the war in Ukraine either. So in the two major conflicts that are affecting us on the globe today in the biggest possible way, you know, it seems that there is no real substantive change, right? Isn't that what Biden said when he ran in 2020 to the rich donors, that there'll be no substantial change or something like that?
Nothing will fundamentally change.
I think that's about what we can expect from Harris. But, you know, you never know. I mean, she's bringing in some advisors from the Obama administration for her campaign. So will she be more open to dealing with Iran if she was to win, like President Obama? Perhaps. Will she be more open to lessening the blockade on Cuba like President Obama? Perhaps. I mean, that has been one of the biggest surprises of a lot of the Democrats, that Biden has basically rode back the handful of things you can say that Obama did that were generally positive. So would she perhaps switch gears on some of those points? You know, hard to say, but I do think there's at least some possibility of it. But again, even that was not really a fundamental change. And, you know, the entire whole idea of the JCPOA was to make it easier to pivot to Asia and increase the war danger, at least against China. So I'm not expecting big change there, but certainly I'm not expecting big change vis-a-vis Israel. But I am sort of bracing myself, and we all probably should, for there to be a lot of attempts to do cosmetic change, because she understands the dangers electorally to not speaking to the many millions of Democrats who are deeply concerned about the genocide in Gaza.
Certainly, Eugene. I know with the little time we have left, I wanted to ask you some of your kind of concluding thoughts here, which to me is really the big question, which is that there's kind of a whiplash moment I think many of us are having in movement spaces, especially. I mean, people have been gearing up and building this mass campaign. I mean, it's Genocide Joe. People are standing for Palestinians. They're standing against the genocide. And so much of the focus has been on Joe Biden. And now I think there's a new kind of element that we're dealing with a Kamala presidency or a presidential run. Because what is being said and what I'm seeing, kind of the shift being made, is that we have to defend democracy. I mean, there's a real actually embracing of that. I think with Joe Biden, there was a understanding and a rejection of, like, well, you know, Joe Biden, how much different is he really than Trump? How is he really going to defend democracy? He's allowed us to get to this state and this point. But I do think there's a revitalization of that hope, which I'm excited to see in general. I think hope is great. But regardless, I would love to get your thoughts a bit on this change and how the left should orient towards this new campaign, and thinking about the overarching goals of what people who are fighting for a better world, who are fighting for something different, what should they be saying in the face of this new wave of unrelenting pressure of, we have to support Kamala, we have to vote blue. What do we say to that?
Well, they said you had to vote blue in 2020 to save democracy and prevent Trump. And then next thing you know, Trump is back as the Republican Party candidate and is poised to potentially win the election. So whatever happened to vanquishing Trump? I think that when we look at the context of the lesser of two evils, you've seen that since 1980, they've said vote for the lesser of two evils, whether we're talking about voting for Carter over Reagan, whether it was Mondale over Reagan, whether it was Dukakis over George H.W. Bush, whether it was Clinton over George H.W. Bush, whether it was Clinton again, I guess, over Bob Dole, but no one really cared about that. People remember the 96 election, there wasn't much of a campaign. Voting for Al Gore instead of voting for Ralph Nader in 2000 against George W. Bush. Voting for John Kerry over George W. Bush. Even though John Kerry was the first person to propose a surge of troops to Iraq, they said people who are anti-war should still vote for Kerry. We could go on and on and on, but the political center of the country is still only moved further to the right. And I think we have to understand that the move to the right is structural not personal first and foremost. The move to the right, which many people call neoliberalism, is a decision that the bipartisan billionaire donors who control both political parties decided on in the middle of the 1970s. Capitalism was in a state of decline. They said we need to reverse that state of decline. The easiest way for us to do that is to wage a war against the working class and increase our own profits at the expense of everything else. That is, in fact, what they have done. Whether it's globalization and the hollowing out of the Midwest, whether it's the wars they've waged around the world to try to suppress any other government or country that wants to be against this agenda, whether it's the evisceration of any and all social programs that are existing, whether or not it's the steady reduction of taxes for the richest people and individuals and things like Trump in 2017, giving a $1 trillion transfer of wealth to the billionaires through his tax cut that he put in. I mean, all these things have been consistent. They've been generally consistent across presidents. And so ultimately, where the red lines are going to continue to move to the right, because moving to the right means more pro-capitalist. It means a hardcore attempt to restore profits. And as long as there is not a significant increase in the dynamism of capitalism, which there is not, we'll see a drift to the right. And on top of that, the fact that the Democrats speak to the problems but don't propose solutions that meet the scale of the problem means that they increase the level of anger, frustration, and helplessness amongst the population. And since that seems status quo, it means the far right semi-fascist and fascist forces whose odious views are so far outside the status quo then appear to be the real change makers, the people who are really shaking it up, and the people who can't really figure out why is it that we're not doing anything that we should be doing to build up our own country, start to say, well, maybe these people will do something different, because it seems like all the rich people and all the big people hate them, even though, you know, 20 billionaires at least are backing Trump. But the perception, the media, the perception is that it's outside the status quo. So you actually create, by not meeting or resolving the problems, more of a base for the far right to be organized within. And that also will continue with any of them. You want to have the new Cold War against China? Well, it's already stated that dividing the world into blocks already could reduce global GDP 7 to 12%. That means the world's going to be poorer. It's going to be hungrier, which means more people are going to be on the move and more wars are going to take place. And we see immigration, we see wars have played a big role in driving the rise of the far right in this country and elsewhere, everywhere else. You can look at the increase in cops, Biden said, and I sure Harris will go with it, 100,000 new cops on the street, more border patrol agents. Well, we know that there is an interrelationship between the border patrol, the police, these border vigilantes, these groups that have propped up over the years, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and many others. So by bolstering that security apparatus, you're already leaning into the social base and supercharging the social base. So I say all that just to say, the only way to pull things back in the other direction is to have a clear and determined poll that shows what the real solutions are to the problems that are facing people in the United States and around the world, and that they're not offered by the two major parties, and that the only way we can win is for people to organize and get ready. I mean, when people started talking about abolition against the two major parties at that time, the Democrats and the Whigs, people said, oh, they're crazy. It's just a small band of crazy people, these abolitionists. No one's for that. Why don't they just work in the two major parties? They're taking away votes from this person or from that person. They're making it easier for the slave owners to succeed. But if it wouldn't have been for the small band of people in groups like the Liberty Party and the American Anti-Slavery Society, the writers, the runaway slaves, all these other people fighting in small organizations and groups saying that we will not compromise on the issue of slavery, there never would have been a clear hole in which others who were anti-slavery could rally to that ultimately pulled society back in the opposite direction. And I think it's one of these things that people say, maybe in the future, maybe the next time, but if you don't start building these kind of alternatives now, it will never in fact take place. And as long as we continue to go at the lesser of two evils, things will continue to slide to the right, because we won't be counteracting the structural power of the billionaires who want to move the political system to the right because of their own profit making. We need structural power coming from the masses of working class and oppressed people that can go head up against that, fight for the base of people who are in both major parties in the working class and the oppressed communities, bring them into that camp and push back against the rich and the elites to pull this country and make a radical, much needed U-turn to save the planet, to save humanity, and to save all of us.
And it reminds me of Charlie Brown, Lucy in That Football. You know, yep. Every time, it's next time. It's every time. It's, oh, this one's about saving democracy. Next time, we'll give you your health care.
Right, because everyone's talking about Project 2025. And they're like, oh, Project 2025. They want to destroy unions. They want to destroy civil rights. They want to destroy women's rights. All of that is true. When has that not been the Republican Party platform. I mean, are people, have they been missing the last 30 years?
Fact.
Starting with Reagan, especially, they wanted to eliminate all affirmative action. They wanted to obviously eliminate a woman's right to choose, which they've actually succeeded in with capturing the Supreme Court. They've done everything possible to eviscerate unions and all protections for unions and hobble the NLRB. And that's not just the NLRB itself, but also by putting in all these terrible judges to try to over time have all of these negative views. They obviously have wanted to roll back the Voting Rights Act. They already did that. They gutted the Section 5 preclearance specifically. So ultimately, I'm not saying that what's in Project 2025 is good. In fact, all of it is, basically all of it is terrible. But this is actually the traditional program that Republicans have been implementing for over 40 years, bit by bit, piece by piece, from multiple different directions, many of it culminating right now in what we're seeing in the Supreme Court. And people are acting like this is some sort of unique fear or unique thing that has happened. And that is just not true. And I don't say that to minimize it, but I say that to raise to people's understanding that the Republicans are extremely right wing. And the Democrats have moved very far to the right in order to try to combat the appeal of the Republicans on multiple different levels. But let's remember, the civil rights movement was taking place under a fascist dictatorship in the Jim Crow South. People were being killed, they were being lynched, they were being beaten. The abolitionist movement, the whole federal government was against them. The Fugitive Slave Act said that they didn't even have the right to harbor fugitive slaves, that you could go anywhere and bring them back. We could go on and on. I mean, the slave South, even more of a fascist dictatorship than Jim Crow. I mean, obviously, when you look at a country like France, where everyone's talking about what's going on in France, the New Popular Front, there's all these different things are happening. Well, they're building on an anti-fascist tradition that is based on people who fought under the Nazi dictatorship to bring them down. So the idea that we lose all agency because of Project 2025, that everything is just going to be over all of a sudden, is totally fake. It doesn't actually really comport with the extreme right-wing agenda we've already seen from the Republicans, and it certainly doesn't comport with the history of how people's movements can fight under any conditions and win and succeed. Because again, if you don't build the type of pull and organization that can pull society back in the other direction, you cannot win. The people who were building the anti-fascist movement against the Nazis in Europe, they are the reason why things were able to become more progressive after World War II. Well, there's many reasons, but that was one of the main reasons, because they stood strong against the Nazis with a totally different program, even though they were weaker, they were stronger, they were being tortured, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to say that, because I think, you know, there's so much doom and gloom, but really organized people can be organized money and organized power anytime, even if it's an uphill climb.
You know, really, next time has to be now. We can't wait. We do not have the luxury of waiting for next time. Well, Eugene, you have been very generous with your time, as you always are with us. We really appreciate having you on the show. We have been joined for this conversation by activist, author, journalist Eugene Puryear. He's also the host of Freedom Side Live on Breakthrough News, which airs every Thursday on YouTube. Thanks again, Eugene.
Hey, thank you guys so much. And shout out to the whole Covert Action family. You guys are doing great.
Thank you.
You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We'll be right back shortly with more of our show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin. Covert Action has been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We're back now with more of our show. And now for a special for our listeners on the radio. You know, we were off last week. We know that WBAI was doing an amazing job covering the RNC, but we missed you. So we wanted to bring you part of our conversation with Brian Becker that we had last week about the assassination attempt on Donald Trump and what that means for the movement. And I think it's actually very telling, and we can still learn a lot from that conversation that happened last week. So again, we're going to go right into part of this conversation that we had with Brian Becker, host of the Socialist Program, about the Trump assassination attempt. Again, this was last week.
The attempted assassination of Donald Trump on July 13th changed the political situation in the United States, and especially surrounding the 2024 election, in an instant. The Biden campaign canceled events and advertisements, while the Trump campaign began preparing for the Republican National Convention happening this week. Within minutes of the shooting, the chorus from mainstream commentators and politicians effectively had one voice. Republicans and Democrats alike condemned political violence in the United States and for Americans, and called on Americans to come together despite our political differences. But who is their solidarity really with? Political violence continues in this country and across the world in the forms of hunger, homelessness, skyrocketing medical debt, famine, sanctions, and war, and beyond. So to help make sense of this quickly shifting situation and how the ruling class is attempting to take advantage of it, we are joined today by Brian Becker, host of the Socialist Program. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Great to be here.
So, Brian, I do want to get right into it. I'd love to get some of your thoughts on the situation. Of course, it's developing. We don't know where things might be in a day or two. But regardless, what do you make of this assassination attempt and its relationship to how it has shifted domestic politics, and also some of the details surrounding the assassination attempt? Is this really what we want to be focusing on or not? You know, I want to get your thoughts on this.
Right. Of course, it's too early to really know in great detail that much about the assassination attempt. We can see some of the political impact of the assassination attempt right away. Of course, for the person who lost their life and their family who's grieving, I mean, this is a terrible moment. For others who were critically injured, you know, we have to think about this not simply from a point of geostrategic politics, but also from the human side. And again, some of that has gotten lost in all the hullabaloo about what it means politically. So I think it's important for us to acknowledge that this was, again, a terrible loss of life. Politically speaking, I think it's important for the progressive movement, for the left, for the working class movement, to provide some historical context and then to try to evaluate what does it mean for the upcoming election. From the historical context point of view, you can see that there are moments or periods in U.S. history where assassination attempts of political leaders are very impactful on society, and also reflective of a deep, profound political instability that's going on within ruling class circles. One need only think about the November 22nd, 1963 assassination of JFK in Dallas, Texas. Shortly thereafter, the U.S. massively escalated the war in Vietnam. You could think about the June 1968 assassination of Kennedy's brother, RFK Jr. He would have likely gotten the Democratic nomination. He was committed to ending the war in Vietnam. He won the California primary. He was on his way to become the Democratic nominee, and I would certainly have beaten Richard Nixon. Hubert Humphrey, after Kennedy was killed, became the nominee. He was pro-war. He lost to Nixon. And the war dragged on for another 5 years, and more than a million more Vietnamese people died, and tens of thousands of American soldiers either were killed or had life-changing injuries. We can think also of the assassination attempt that ended the campaign of racist segregationist George Wallace in 1972. He was the right-wing flank of the Nixon administration by putting Wallace out of the race. The far right had no alternative. They gravitated towards Nixon. Just for context, George Wallace had won numerous states in the Electoral College in 1968, so it wasn't without impact. And then we can think, of course, about the assassination of Malcolm X. in 1965. Before that, Medgar Evers. After that, the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, 1968, in 120 cities burned down when the Black community, Black America, rose up as a nationwide insurrection. All of these events are, one, reflective of instability, but also very, very impactful. The assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan in 1981 had very little impact on politics. But here we are with Donald Trump. I mean, in the context of the 2024 election, I would say this. Joe Biden's campaign was already sinking. The attempted assassination of Trump deprives Biden of the one talking point that Biden was using to argue that his campaign should be sustained. And his main argument was, I'm not Donald Trump. I'm the barrier to Donald Trump. I'm the guy who beat Donald Trump. And I am the only thing standing between Donald Trump and the basically the destruction of democracy as we know it and the future. And so he was this indispensable figure. Now the Democrats can't really personalize the attack against Donald Trump because it'll play into the right-wing narrative, which is basically, as Donald Trump Jr. said, blaming the left for the attempted assassination, even though there's no evidence whatsoever of that. So I think it strengthens Trump a great deal. He's now, like at the Republican National Convention, he's almost like a religious, he's like the second Messiah. He's landed in Milwaukee at the RNC, and he's being treated with such reverential sort of conduct that it would be like Jesus himself had just walked into the room. He cements his hold over the Republican Party and really weakens the Democrats. So I think we're already, having stayed with Joe Biden, on their way to defeat in November.
Yeah, Brian, I want to ask more about this instability and how it kind of grows and meanders, because, you know, most politicians, you know, the Democrats certainly, and, you know, Republicans who may be supporting Trump because he is going to be their party's nominee, but are Trump people, let's say, have been calling for calm.
Right.
But then Trump, we found out on Monday, picked J.D. Vance as his vice presidential candidate. And Vance posted on Twitter almost immediately on Saturday. He says, quote, "Today is not just some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign is that President Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs. That rhetoric led directly to President Trump's attempted assassination." And again, that is posted within an hour at the most, possibly minutes of the assassination attempt. This is from J.D. Vance on Twitter. So, you know, we don't know when Trump made the decision, of course, to pick Vance, but certainly he had been in the running for some time. Maybe this bumped him up on the list. Maybe it didn't. Could be completely irrelevant. But what does that choice and confirming Vance as the vice presidential candidate 2 days after this, the assassination attempt and the statement, say about the approach that the Trump wing is taking, you know, towards this instability and where it could go? Whereas the Democrats have, I mean, they've basically stopped campaigning. I've heard from people here in New Haven that for local races, they were asked to stop campaigning by the Democratic Party over the weekend, not even for Biden, but for local primaries that are coming up in a few weeks. They were asked to stop campaigning. Very, very different approaches that are being taken. But what does it say to you, Brian, about the distinctions in how they're coming about this?
Well, and J.D. Vance, when he made that statement, which of course was false and provocative and sort of semi-fascistic right after the assassination attempt, that was him before he was part of the Trump team. The thing that to watch is, how does J.D. Vance sound now? Because J.D. Vance is not an independent political figure anymore. He's number two. He's under the discipline and direction of Donald Trump. And Trump has some decisions to make. It's very hard for Trump to take the high road and say, look, let's bring the country together. It's too divisive. This is an indication that we have to unify. It's very hard for him to stick with it. But if you listen to his comments at the start or right before the start of the RNC in Milwaukee, he said he was preparing this humdinger of a speech, as he put it, to roast Joe Biden and to attack Joe Biden. But now he's decided to focus on the theme of national unity. Now, if they really follow through with that, again, it's going to be very hard for Donald Trump to stick to that program. But it would be a smart program on the part of Donald Trump. If you think about it this way, from the narrow point of what Trump wants, all Trump really wants is to win. By him winning, he shields himself with immunity from any further prosecutions. He also can't run another time unless something untoward happened. This would be his second term. So constitutionally speaking, if the Constitution is still in place, which I assume it will be, he won't run again. So he's going to be a one-term president. So what does Donald Trump want? He doesn't have to placate the right anymore because the right is 100% with him. He does want to be able to win the election. The smart move on Trump's part would be to move a little bit towards the center. In other words, not to move in a hard right fascistic direction. You had to notice that he said he didn't know anything about Project 2025, which of course is a lie. Project 2025 is written by his senior top former advisors, the Heritage Foundation. It's a 900-page document for a radical, you know, sort of reorganization of the capitalist government for the purposes of cementing big businesses' hold on everything. Trump said, oh, I don't know that much about that. Why did he do that? He did it because the Project 2025 is going to be very unpopular with parts of the working class, parts of the middle class. So Trump is tacking a little bit to the center. He's emphasizing that he has support from the Black community. I mean, if Trump is smart, he will pretend to be a little bit more towards the center rather than going to the far right. He doesn't need to go to the far right. Trump himself is a chameleon. He does not have an ideological sort of anchor. He adopted a very right-wing position in order to win in 2016. He kept that narrative going. But he's Trump. He can move any which way. You look at what they did with the RNC program. He said, I don't want to make a full ban on abortion. Now, the Republicans have said for 40 years, that's an ethical issue. That's a moral issue. And as soon as Trump said, no, we're going to drop that and leave it, quote, up to the states, the RNC complied with him. The ethical moral issue disappeared instantly as long as Trump told them, no, I don't want to get saddled with abortion going into the 2024 election. Why? The evisceration of abortion rights cuts against Trump in the election. So he wants to minimize it. We shouldn't be consumed with the idea that we're sort of moving in the direction of fascism. Fascism is always an organic danger in capitalism. Fascism is an organic part of capitalism in decline, capitalism in crisis, capitalism in its degenerative stage. Germany was a progressive country, the home of Marx and Engels and the largest socialist party in Europe. I mean, it was an inherently fascistic society. It succumbed to fascism for a multiple number of reasons, but it was the crisis of German capitalism. So as American capitalism goes into greater and greater crisis, there is always the danger of fascism. So I don't want to minimize that, but at the same time, I don't think we should be orienting right now that a Trump victory means fascism or J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance is just a hustler grifter. I mean, he'll say anything. He'll do whatever he needs to do. Like so many of these people, including Biden's entourage, they're all grifters and they mainly care about themselves. So we have to keep a keen eye on the evolving situation. Again, I don't want to minimize the danger of a Trump presidency, but I do think we should be in a fighting mode and not think that Trump has all the cards here.
Certainly, Brian, I know we don't have you for too much longer, but I did want to say I really appreciate your take on this conversation around unity. The Democrats are really trying to invoke this idea of unity. And I think it resonates with people who have been very tired of how deeply divided the U.S. is and how difficult, you know, the path forward for that would be. I mean, a lot of people are looking out and saying, where do we go from here? So I would love for you to speak a little bit more about towards what really is the path forward in this time where people are seeking a sense of unity. Obviously, that's not going to happen in the particular context of Trump and Biden and beyond that. But I would love for you to speak to that. And the other question I'd love for you to really address with our time left is how you feel internationally this assassination attempt is being seen and kind of in the bigger grand scheme of global politics, what reverberations we might see.
In terms of unity, you know, the ruling class elites, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are two ruling class elites. They have more in common with each other than what separates them. And, you know, they're like, the Democrats right now are doing everything to kick Claudia de la Cruz off the ballot in Georgia and elsewhere. Same with Jill Stein. Any independent progressive candidate, they want to get them off the ballot. This is a capitalist duopoly. It's like a capitalist dictatorship, except it has two heads, like an elephant and a donkey. They have a certain degree of ruling class unity. They're unified around the military industrial complex. They always fund it. They're unified around the genocide in Gaza. They're for it. They're unified really in supporting the NATO and the proxy war against Russia. I mean, Trump and J.D. Vance are sounding a little bit different, but I think that's all demagoguery. They're all for Wall Street. They're all for the banks. They're against the unions. They have all that in common. And the working class, the poor, and even parts of the, at least the lower middle class, and some parts of the general middle class who vote Republican and some vote Democrat, they too have more in common than one might think. They have the problem of inflation. They have the problem of high gas prices. They have the, you go to a store and buy a dozen eggs. It costs a lot more than it did 5 years ago. You know, for young people, the idea of buying a home, the so-called American dream, that's out of reach for most young working class folks at this point. Instead of dividing society into so-called red and blue and having everybody identify, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, as a socialist myself, as a Marxist, you know, as a longtime organizer and activist, I think it's important to emphasize we don't want to have these sort of this kind of division. We need to have a class unity. And what does class unity mean? It means we have a common problem. We, the working class, have a common problem. That doesn't mean we're going to have unity that sacrifices our principles. Like if people in the who are voting for Trump, you know, are angry about inflation, but they're also racist against immigrants, we have to make the case to them that they are pursuing a fool's errand, that their anti-immigrant bias is just spoon-fed BS from the bosses, from the capitalists, to try to divide workers, that workers coming from Mexico or Central America or Africa are just like them, that these families are trying to work, they're trying to make ends meet, they're trying to feed their families, they want to go to a doctor when their kids are sick. You know, we have to build class unity that rejects racism and xenophobia and bigotry against the LGBTQ community or the deprivation of women's rights. You know, we have to stand on that basis. But that said, we have to be able to say to the working class that at the moment has been sort of tricked into supporting either Biden or Trump, that that's a dead end. These two parties are only going to represent the capitalists. They're only going to represent the landlords. You know, capitalist democracy boils down to, in America, you get to vote every 2 or 4 years for who's going to oppress you for the next 2 or 4 years. Like, that's not democracy. Democracy means we should have free health care. Democracy means housing should never be more than 5% of your income. Democracy means that when your kids want to go to college, it should be free, that it should be considered a constitutional right, not a privilege for those who can pay. You know, we have a right to have a clean environment. You know, capitalist corporations are being unregulated right now by the Supreme Court. That was the Chevron decision. What does democracy mean if you can't go outside and breathe clean air? The fact that you can vote for some rich person every 2 or 4 years, but you can't breathe clean air or drink clean water, that's not democracy. That's a sham. So we want to build unity by rejecting the unity of the capitalists, the so-called capitalist unity. And the demagoguery and hypocrisy, they say violence has no place in American politics. Well, no, American politics is dripping in violence. Tell that to the people in Gaza who are being crushed by American bombs, 2,000-pound bombs, 1,800-pound bombs. Tell them that violence has no place in American politics. In fact, violence occupies center place in American politics, and it always has. So all of this BS from, and by BS, of course, I just mean bad sociology, from the capitalists about unity, we have to reject that unity and build a real unity, a unity between working class folks against our common enemy. And our common enemy is not in Tehran, it's not in Moscow, it's not in Beijing, it's in Wall Street. It's in the military-industrial complex, and we have to keep our eyes focused on who our real problem is.
Without a doubt, Brian. I mean, one of the things that, as you're speaking, is on the question of the political violence and that hypocrisy is the way that the Cuban president responded, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. He said, as victims of attacks and terrorism for 65 years, Cuba ratifies its historic position of condemning all forms of violence, the arms business, and the escalation of political violence in the U.S., lead to incidents such as the one that took place this Saturday in that country. I mean, I think very well said, summarized by
beautiful
by Miguel Díaz-Canel. And then there were a couple other responses actually on the international stage that I wanted to highlight here. One of them was from AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the president of Mexico. In any case, we condemn what happened to former President Donald Trump. Violence is irrational and inhuman. Lula of Brazil said the attack against former President Donald Trump must be vehemently repudiated by all defenders of democracy and dialogue in politics. What we have seen today is totally unacceptable. And Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says, on behalf of Venezuela as a whole, of all of our people, we reject and repudiate the attack against former President Donald Trump. We wish him a speedy. And again, that was part of our episode from last week with Brian Becker. If you missed the episode, you can go to our podcast feed to catch the whole thing. Well, we are going to have to leave it right there. We were joined today for the first part of our show by activist, author, and journalist Eugene Puryear, host of The Freedom Side Live on Breakthrough News. We have a special announcement for especially our listeners in the Washington, D.C. area. Be sure to visit us at the Whistleblower Summit Monday, July 29th. There'll be a book signing with John Kiriakou and Jeremy Kuzmarov, 6 to 10 p.m. at the Busboys and Poets location at 14th and V. And then on Tuesday, July 30th at 3 p.m. at American University's McKinley Building in the Doyle Foreman Theater. Join us for our panel, Blowing the Whistle on the CIA's Covert Actions. That's going to be featuring John Kiriakou, Lou Wolf, Jeremy Kuzmarov, Kit Clarenberg, and moderated by Gloria Guglio. So again, that's Tuesday the 30th, 3 p.m., American University McKinley Building, second floor for the panel, and Monday the 29th, book signing with John and Jeremy at Busboys and Poets, 6 p.m. at 14th and V. We hope that folks in the D.C. area will be able to join us, support Covert Action, and support the Whistleblower Summit that happens every year. If you like what you heard today and you want to support independent journalism, please go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine and become a patron. We can only do this show with the support of our listeners. So if you want to hear more, be sure to go to the Patreon to support. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin with Chris Garaffa.
And Rachel Hu. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you can find podcasts. Just go ahead and search for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. We're all out of time for today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.
Hi, I'm Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Bird Note. Some of us like to talk with our hands. At one time, scientists thought only primates used their limbs to gesture and signal to other individuals. More recently, we've learned a number of animals can point to something to communicate with another member of their species. But one gesture was thought unique to humans. You might use it when you reach a door at the same time as someone else. After you. No, after you. Researchers studying birds called Japanese tits, relatives of the chickadees and titmice in North America, noticed that mates raising chicks together often fluttered their wings near the entrance of their nest box. Knowing these birds have complex ways of communicating through sound, the researchers began carefully observing them to see what the wing fluttering might mean. After recording hundreds of examples of wing fluttering, the pattern became clear. The first bird to wing flutter would politely wait at the nest entrance while the other one entered. So the wing flutter was a signal, much like that arm-sweeping gesture that people use to mean, after you. Following this discovery, scientists are paying even closer attention to what birds might be saying with their wings. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This is Bird Note. Many people would tell you that hearing bird song, like the one from this hermit thrush, puts them in a good mood. Recently, scientists have tried to put numbers to this effect that many of us have noticed. One study has shown that people reported relief from feelings of worry and paranoia after hearing just a few minutes of bird song. Researchers had almost 300 people listen to 6 minutes of either traffic noise or bird song. Before and after listening, they filled out questionnaires asking them about feelings of anxiety, paranoia, and depression. People that had spent a few minutes immersed in the sounds of birds had lower levels of paranoia and anxiety than those who only listened to traffic noise. It's the first time that researchers have found that bird song can decrease feelings of paranoia. While they're still working on understanding why, it's possible that hearing birds singing makes people feel like they're in a safe environment, free from threats, and gives their brains the signal to relax a bit. We hope that this quick show about birds has put you in a better mood. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support for Bird Note is provided by Cindy Gantz in honor and memory of former Bird Note board member Tom Darden and by generous listeners around the world.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality?
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.